Hi, everybody. Welcome to a very special edition of Profiles of Color. It's always interesting to me how much we can learn when we can pull back the proverbial curtain and hear an open, honest perspective about growing up in the shadow of an iconic legend. I had such a privilege chatting with Tuskegee Airman, Air Force retired, Brigadier General Charles E. McGee, who, by the way, is 6 months from turning 102 years old, along with his two daughters and son. Although I've known them for a number of years, I had a lot of fun talking with his daughter, Yvonne McGee, his son, Ron McGee, and his oldest daughter, Charlene McGee Smith. And guess what? They are all chips off the old block and very accomplished in their own right. Ron had a successful Air Force career as a pilot, followed by a second career flying for United Airlines, and after two retirements, is currently an instructor pilot teaching other pilots how to fly the Boeing 777 and the 787 Dreamliner. And then there's Charlene. In addition to being the author of Tuskegee Airmen, the biography of Charles E. McGee, Air Force fighter and combat record holder, Charlene has her PhD in multi-interdisciplinary studies at Ohio University. And then there's the youngest, Yvonne. Yvonne is a proud graduate of the HBCU Hampton University with a bachelor's degree in mass media art. And Yvonne could easily teach a masterclass on editing after having over 45 years of video editing experience. But even with those kind of backgrounds, and when Brigadier General McGee or one of them get an interview request, it's usually to talk about the general's storied, highly decorated military career and accomplishments. And while he has had the opportunity to share some personal anecdotes about his family, it usually comes full circle to the three wars he flew in and lots of flying stories to boot. Not to mention his flying a private Honda jet for his 99th birthday, a Cirrus Vision jet for his 100th birthday, as well as a Cessna M2 private jet on his 100th birthday. And we'll breeze right past last year's pre-pandemic pinning of his honorary Brigadier General star at the White House, the standing ovation at the State of the Union, and his participation in the Super Bowl coin toss. All of that said, I wanted this conversation to be a little different. So I asked the general and his family if I could talk with them about everything else. And so you have it, an illuminating, casual conversation with the 101-year-old general and his three children. Well, Charlene, I will hand off to you first and ask you if you would to kind of go back and tell us a little bit about the beginnings of the upbringing as you were growing up and your dad was becoming more famous by the day.
Early on, I had no appreciation of what he was doing. So I was more concerned about whether I had to eat my peas before he let me get up from the table or, you know, later, whether I could get the keys if I wanted to go somewhere. So it wasn't until really early adulthood that I began to understand the bigger picture. So much of my early time would be pretty much similar to what others might experience if they're fortunate enough to have a loving and caring father in the home. I do remember a couple of early lessons that he taught me. They set the tone for the development of the values and principles and the things that I wanted to do or was able to do for the rest of my life. And some of it wasn't always pretty, but it was always important and it was always good. So
nicely put.
Okay. Well, I'll tell you a couple of examples. I remember as a youngster over in the Philippines, I used to climb the telephone pole and I used to love to sit perched up there. And of course it made my mother so nervous. And she told Dad, you need to teach her to, you know, you need to get her down from that clothes pole. I said, telephone, it's a clothes pole. And tell her not to go up there again. And Dad said, well, what's the worst that can happen? And Mom said, well, she could fall off and break her leg. And he said, well, broken legs heal.
Oh, there's a hard lesson, but a truthful one. Ron, you were nodding in agreement, so you apparently remember some of these things.
Yeah, I remember trying to climb that same pole and have her pushing me off.
Man.
Wow. Yeah. Well, so
other examples. I was telling him yesterday, I was thinking about the time that he wanted me to learn to swim. And so on the base where we were, and I think we were still in the Philippines at that time, they had a officers club swimming pool. And when we were there, he took me to the deep end and threw me in.
Oh, so Dad liked to make you guys just jump straight in and learn what you needed to learn. Is that right, General McGee?
I don't know. Maybe it happened that way.
Oh, yes.
Now Dad suddenly only remembers what he did in the war, right?
Oh, exactly.
You have to look at the results.
There you go.
That's it exactly. I think what we learned from him through those kind of circumstances is be willing to take risks.
Yeah.
You've got to, if there's something you want, in this case, learning to swim, you got to go for it. But the other thing I think we learned is because he was our safety net. He had instilled it. He'd not only given us unconditional love, but he'd given us a sense of security. So we were willing to take that leap, knowing that he was our safety net.
Sure. Ron, you kind of followed in your dad's footsteps as a pilot, Air Force and airline, and you're still flying and you're still teaching others how to fly some pretty big aircraft. But when you were young, when did it kind of occur to you that was a direction you wanted to go? Or how did that happen?
It happened back in the Philippines, actually. I went to an air show at the base where we are, Clark Air Force Base, and they had an air show, and the plane was just full of, the sky was full of airplanes and people jumping out, paratroopers, and they had some fighter jets come by. I was in amazement. I looked up and went, what in the world are they doing, and how are they doing that? I've got to do that. And so I got the bug early on. I can remember running around while Charlene was climbing the clothesline pole. I'd run around with dirt in my hands. And because some of the planes, leave a little concho or some of that. So I'd run around and dropping this dirt off out of my hands like I was flying a plane. And I got the bug at that point. And it really helped that Dad, Dad never pushed me into aviation at all. But I got because he did fly, I was always around the aircraft. And it became my goal early on. I never changed. Like most kids, I wanted to fly and be an inventor. Fly and do scuba or fly and do something else. But
right.
It was always number one.
Yeah. So were you like Charlene? Did you have a different appreciation as you got older? So when you were young, did you maybe not realize how significant the accomplishments that your dad were making were?
Absolutely true. Did not recognize it at all. He was like Charlene said, just like a loving father that, he flew a lot and was gone sometimes, but when he was home, there was no doubt that, that he loved you or that he was the head of the household either when he was home. And, but they didn't talk about it. He didn't talk about his achievements. He didn't talk about being as a group with Tuskegee or either of that. He was his job and, you do your job. And so it wasn't until actually I was graduated from college and in the military before I actually started understanding some of the stories. And we started understanding the stories when Tuskegee Incorporated, because they used to get together every now and then, they decided, we need to incorporate and have an annual convention. And that was in 1972. And when they did that, everybody then started hearing the stories, because they would get together and start talking amongst themselves about what they did and who did what. And
that's when you started learning more about it.
Exactly. Everybody stepped back and like, what? We haven't heard any of this. And of course, a lot of people felt the same way. And then we started documenting the history of it. But it was much later in life, not growing up.
Yeah. General McGee, I've heard that a few times that you really kind of kept your professional life out of the home front. When you were home, you were home. And then when you were out flying, on behalf of the country. Can you tell us what you were thinking when at that time in terms of why you kind of delineate it like that?
That's not easy to answer, because thinking back, I was saying, well, I'll do this. I think what I'm thankful for is I had a good mate. Their mother was really the one that did the bringing up. I was all flying, and I don't know what kind of a stick she was using, but
I'm sure one of them could tell us.
Wait till your dad gets home was one of them.
Oh, that's a good one.
Go get me a switch was another.
What's that, Ron?
Go get me a switch was another.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Well, let's check in with the baby of the three, the youngest, Yvonne. Yvonne, do you remember a switch or waiting till your dad gets home?
But mom did most of the disciplining. She was a wonderful military wife, mm-hmm. military officer's wife. And she made sure that dad had a place that was not chaotic when he came home. So he didn't have to do too much when he got home because she would take care of it ahead of time. And we understood that dynamic very early. I think I shared with a group before, I said, when I was growing up, you know, having an older brother and sister, I figured out that he was a pretty important person because I realized that we didn't eat dinner. We could have the food sitting out, but we didn't eat till he sat down at the table. and that was another thing. I said, we were almost like, I don't want to say Ozzy and Harriet, but almost in that they really believed in, we had dinner time together. Most of the time we had breakfast. We were up and had most of our breaks together until schedules changed. But that was something that they were sticklers about, mm-hmm. is that you weren't late for dinner. He raised us, so we weren't going to be late for anything. we were always, the McGee's were usually the first ones to arrive someplace, and didn't matter if we had to wait, we weren't going to be late.
You were on time. When you guys sat down for dinner, was it a sit down conversation and you would talk about family stuff or whatever?
I don't think it wasn't like, Blue Bloods where it was an intentional, we're going to, air out our week or anything. But I remember the conversations of being just pretty general. We didn't look at TV during dinner back in those days, not when we were young and stuff. So we had, I think this is probably normal conversations. But
we're only talking one or two TVs and three or four channels, right?
Yes. But that wasn't something that, was at the table. So we just had regular conversation. But dad, again, he I don't remember him telling us anything about his day. Maybe later on in high school, he might talk about things that were going on at the office and then that kind of stuff. But I don't really remember. It was just kind of what we considered a normal Air Force family.
Sure. Yeah. General McGee, Miss Frances was the love of your life. You've said that on many occasions. How did you guys meet and finally marry? I hear it was a whirlwind type of a situation.
Yeah, well, she was a senior at the University of Illinois and I was a freshman. But one day I was walking south on campus and she happened to be walking north. We passed each other. And after a few steps, I turned around to look again, and she had stopped and turned around to look.
So you both did a 180.
But we looked. We didn't go talk then, but I followed up. It turned out I was attending the Methodist Church, AME Church, that was a block from the Baptist Church where she was in.
Oh, wow.
Active Sundays. And it turns out that with church out, it seems that all the kids would meet across the corner from the her church, and we'd chat. She had her eyes, I think, at the time on one of the Chicago guys.
Dick Taylor.
The names kind of float away from
Dick
me.
Dick Taylor.
And, but... kept my eye on her and kept finding opportunities to chat with her regardless of what the conversation of the group was.
Yeah.
And it just seemed that we hit it off, and that was a good thing for me because I was hooked.
When were you hooked? When did you know? Well, it sounds like you were hooked when you first passed her, but when did you know you wanted to marry her?
In our conversations and meeting after church, and it turned out too that the churches did things together, and there was an activity. And looking back, it might have been a precedent that neither one of us realized, but was at the church, the Tom Thumb wedding. And guess who the ones getting married were?
Yeah.
But this was even before we even realized that that could be the part of our future. We were just youngsters doing what the older folks the church wanted us to do at the time and participating.
But you were the groom. You were the groom, and she was the bride for that.
Yeah.
Yes.
I said the group today, yeah. I don't know if they still do Tom Thumb weddings, Dad. They might have to go look that up.
He left out
myself the part included.
He left out the part about having to learn to dance.
Yes.
Yeah.
Oh, well, let's hear about Brigadier General McGee dancing.
Yeah. He wasn't dancing. That was the problem. And Mom was like the jitterbug.
I had to learn to jitterbug to get close to her.
Okay. I'm sure you learned quickly.
And it turned out that the Kappa House on campus always had something like that going on. We alphas were in the books a little bit more. But you do.
So how did you learn to jitterbug?
Watched.
Okay.
And I don't remember going to anybody, but watching, I said, you do this. And of course, once you grasp hands and get started, that keeps you going.
I think there's probably a lot of practice in your room.
Yeah. Okay, that reminds me of a story.
You know, religion, Christianity has always been a major foundation for you. As far back as we can go. And did that come from your parents, or where did that foundation start? Well,
my dad was in the AME ministry.
Okay.
That kept him moving about. He wasn't a happy camper as I look back on it, because they kept giving him a church that needed the mortgage burned and that type of work, and he was hoping for assignment to a larger church, but it seemed to never happen. So somewhere along the line, he got out of the AME ministry, but didn't get out of his ministry, if you will, but this wasn't the AME.
Gotcha. So you think that had a lot of influence on your attending church as you became an adult, et cetera?
I think so, because it to me was the first learning of you treat others like you want to be treated. And the old saying, sticks and stones will break my bones, but words won't hurt me any. We learn to take things and not let each happening be a tragedy, if you will. And overlooked a lot of things that happened. So racism wasn't, it existed, but it didn't control our lives.
Yeah. Well, that seems to have been the case throughout your life and your career. Ron, it seemed like you had something that this conversation is reminding you of, you wanted to share.
Oh, no, that's all right. We'll bring it up another time. It was just something about learning that, I'll tell you now, it doesn't matter. Talking about Dad learning to dance, I was wondering how long it took him to learn the jitterbug, because we were living in Italy when the twist came out. And Dad could figure out the twist, just could not get it down. And one day, I remember he came out and he had a towel. He was drying himself off with a towel behind him. He was wiping his back like this. And Charlene goes, "That's it! That's it!"
That's
from the beyond, Dad would always dance like he had the twist, like
that
he had a towel.
Is too That is great. That is great. So, Charlene, you were the first child, and so you grew up as the oldest. Did you get a lot of example from your mom in terms of how you were growing and dealing with your younger siblings as they came along, et cetera?
Well, before I answer that, let me say that one of the memories that flashed through my mind as you were talking about early recognition of Dad's importance and significance. And Dad, you're going to have to help me put the right time frame around it. But I remember it was either when we were in Minnesota, and I think it was before North Dakota, but I think you were with NORAD, and they had a defense assignment, of course. And one of the things that used to happen is, you remember the scrambles? There would be an alert that would go off, and it would start a scramble among all of the pilots and all of the support staff. And all of a sudden, everybody was running. And it didn't matter where you were or what you were doing, you dropped it. And then you ran to your plane and got ready to take off. And I think I observed one of those. And that was the first time I thought, dang, that's kind of cool. I mean, to have a job where you're so important that an alarm goes off and you have to
drop what you're doing and run.
You got to go.
Yeah.
And so that was really something to see. And it's kind of stuck in my mind and zipped by there as we were talking about early memories. You know, I think Mom certainly, she kept the home fires burning.
Absolutely.
You know, she made sure, as Yvonne said, that everything at home was, and even when Dad would go for longer TDYs, temporary duty assignments.
Right.
She would make sure that we all knew what we were responsible for, and that would be the case. I think as far as instilling values and principles, they both had a part to play in that. And I remember Dad from very early on, and I say this because, you know, he always made me believe that I could do whatever I set my mind to do. And I don't take that as a given, because I think it would have been easy, as I've said before, for him to believe and to express the fact that I'm a young Black woman in a world that doesn't much appreciate me. So don't set yourself up for disappointment. So he could have given me a very cautious kind of outlook, but he did the opposite.
Yeah.
He just said, you know, if you're willing to dream big and work hard and not give up, you can do anything that you set your mind to.
You know, that reminds me of the story about Ron being told that he could be a good truck driver. That was in high school, Ron?
It was in high school. You know, I'm going to back up a little bit before that, though, because, you know, Charlene was always the very intelligent one in the family, as far as three kids, anyway.
All three of you. You guys are all smart.
Hey, thank you. Thank you very much.
I'll admit it, Charlene. I'll admit it. You know, you're the one that got the straight A's. And so, consequently, I even though Dad had the lessons, I'm sure at some point to my dad and my mother, I was a disappointment because I didn't apply myself, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, I did okay in high school. I didn't do great. I wasn't straight A's. Bill, I had A's, B's, C's. You know, I even had a D in there at some point. I don't remember, but I don't think I had a D, because I probably would not be here today if I had. But anyway, I definitely was not straight A's. But in Belton, Missouri, which is where we were when I was in high school and graduated, there wasn't high expectations for, you know, for the young Black people at the time still. So my counselor called my mother in and said, you know, Ron could learn a trade. I think he'd make a good truck driver. And that was my wake-up call, because I thought,
wait a minute. Got your attention?
Yeah, what are you talking about, truck driver? I'm going to fly an airplane. And so, you know, I got into, I mean, fortunately, I tested well enough in math and science. I'm talking about myself now, but when we took the SATs, I tested very high in the math and sciences, but I was very low in reading and reading comprehension. And I was admitted to University of Kansas. They said, well, we're going to let you in because of your math and science scores. And I actually tested out my first year of math and went straight into second year math as a freshman. Mm-hmm. But you know, I ended up getting a degree in aerospace engineering. And I think that probably surprised my parents, because I had never applied myself before this. So it's not that I couldn't have
a pleasant surprise.
Absolutely.
I think it was a pleasant surprise, yes. But my mother did call the high school when I graduated, and she said, is counselor, you know, so-and-so still there? And they said, yes. She goes, oh, let's come out and make a meeting. So she drove back out to Belton High School and went in there, and she had my diploma in hand. She goes, bam, Aerospace Engineering, University of Kansas, with honors. She goes, that's the guy you said that maybe could learn to drive a truck. And she just grabbed it and walked out of the room. That was it.
Sweet. Would love to have been a fly on the wall for that.
Yeah, I don't even think he said anything. I think, you know, she was gone. She slammed it down, said it.
What could he say?
He was picking his mouth up off the table, off the desk.
Yeah. I see your dad with a big smile. So I take it, General McGee, you have some fond memories of that accomplishment of Ron's and those days.
Well, certainly, but the... It wasn't what I was doing as much as what Frances was doing and what she did for the young folks. And the one thing, even probably not quite on the subject, but all three of them learned how to cook, and she kept me to stay out of my kitchen.
And to this day, from what I hear, they all three still know how to cook.
They know how to cook, and I don't. I know how to turn on the...
Oh, you cook, Dad.
Oh, there was a day I knew 7 minutes on a steak outside. Usually came out pretty good.
7 minutes on a steak.
That's okay, General McGee. My cooking skills are limited. I cook breakfast and a couple of dinners, and I prefer to be out on the grill. So I'm with you.
First, I moved out to the East Coast and stuff, and I was, you know... I was kind of shocked because he was, you know, wilting lettuce and doing all kinds of stuff and fixing food. And I was looking at him, he said, I did know how to do a few things before I met your mother.
Here it comes. Like, this is the part of the family I was hoping we would hear.
There are times when mom spoke that you just listened and didn't say anything. I mean, when she wanted to put the foot down, she did. Dad and I wanted to fly together. And mom said, no, you're not going to fly together. We said, well, you know, we'd like to be able to go do that. That'd be a great thing to do. And she said, no, I'm not going to lose you both at the same time. And I made the mistake of saying, Mom, we're both pretty good pilots. I think we're going to be okay. And she pulled her glass off and she goes, well, what'd I say? And that was it. Dad took off one way and I took off the other. We never flew together.
What, General, you were getting ready to say something? Oh, I guess he was just responding to what you were saying. But, you know, your mom sounded, I call her Miss Frances. She sounded very compassionate at the same time that she was strong, but she was also a compassionate mom, it sounds like. Sounds like she was the best of all.
Indeed. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
Yeah. Now, there were things that were challenging for her being a military wife.
Right.
In those times, absolutely. And so because of Dad's rank and sometimes he was in command, she was forced to be public, you know, a public first lady, so to speak.
Sure.
And some of that she enjoyed more than others. Let me just put it that way. But one of the things that was really difficult for her was when we went to Italy in the early 1960s, they didn't have a high school. So at age 13, I had to go to school in Germany and France, thousands of miles from Dad's base in southern Italy.
Wow.
And that was very difficult for her. And I don't think I appreciated it until later people told me that, you know, she was sad and depressed. And, you know, it was just really hard for her because, as we had said, she was the one that kept the family together. Now the circumstances were forcing us apart before she was ready to do that. So I always feel like some of what Yvonne and Ron got to experience during those years I missed. And I have to listen real carefully when they're telling the stories because it sounds like they were having a good time. And Dad would come and visit me when he could on an assignment or whenever he could get up north to keep up with me. And then I would come back on the holidays. But I always felt like Mom was, you know, being super kind and supportive when I was home because she missed me so much. So yeah. I probably got away with a few things that I wouldn't have otherwise.
You did.
I think the challenges of military life are underappreciated, you know, that especially someone like your father who you know, just accomplished so much and was always on the was always rising through the ranks, et cetera, in his career. But it also had you guys moving. You've already mentioned three or four places. You guys are moving all over the place. Any of you, can you talk a little bit about how that was for you in terms of having to constantly make that adjustment in the military family?
I think it was had pluses and minuses. You know, one thing, because we did move so many times, you learn to make friends quickly, but you don't have lifelong friends, that people that, you know, grew up together. So I think consequently, your attachments that you make with people aren't as close as maybe some other, you know, people who lived in the same spot and grew up from elementary school all the way through, you know, top through high school. So that was a difference. On the other hand, we got to live all over the world and got to experience different cultures. You know, not something you read about in a magazine. We lived there, you know, and so that is something that I think molded all of us. And you can't really put a monetary value, or not a monetary, but a number of value on how much that affected you, you know, but compared to the normal life. But it was definitely different. And I know for myself, I moved more than Charlene and Yvonne, even, because I went in the military also. And then with the airlines, I moved. So kind of my move here now to Vegas, it was my 34th move of my life.
Wow. Yeah. Yvonne, how about you? How did the moving around affect you?
Because you were always, with the exception of when Dad went to Vietnam and I actually got to experience a civilian school, everybody around you was doing the same thing. So you just kind of thought that was just normal military life. But I think it didn't become a challenge for me and poor Dad until high school. I went to four different high schools. And of course, at that time, I'm starting to date too. So my move, my sophomore year from Heidelberg to Hahn was traumatic.
And let's talk about the dating thing for a minute. No, I'm just kidding.
No, but I'm just saying that poor Dad, because I would, you know, it's like, you know, it was the end of the world and he had to sit there and watch me, you know, at the breakfast table, and I'm like, and now he's like, just get it together. So he understood that you know, the trauma at that age, but you know, being a teenage girl too didn't help a lot. But he the moves are interesting. The one thing I remember, though, Dina, you were talking about how he can, you know, raise you, he can do anything. I remember when he went to Vietnam, how he took me around the house and explained that, you know, the things that I would have to do since he was gone. And I'll never forget that instruction. He's, you know, everything from keeping the car maintained and the lawn and everything. But he kind of walked me around and gave me instructions and saying that, you know, these are going to be your responsibilities now. And I'll never forget that he put that responsibility on me and trusted me to do that, you know, and kind of take care of Mom in a way, is what he was saying. But, and one of the reasons too, Dad, and Mom might have shared this with you, but one of the reasons I do remember is because the very first time I was so nervous of changing the oil, I accidentally put it in the power fluid and was shocked when it filled up right away, because the dipstick said it should have been like really low. And
power steering fluid, okay.
Power steering fluid. And so Mom very quietly, I was like going, so I'm cleaning up the mess and everything and realizing what my mistake was. And she came back in the garage with a straw. She said, this is going to be fixed before your father comes up. I had to suck that top oil off, but I didn't do it again. But it wasn't anything to do with your instruction, Dad. You gave perfect instruction. I was just nervous doing it the first time, but I never made that mistake again.
Go ahead.
No, I said, but I remember, you know, just that time and how Mom was so careful when he came back from Vietnam. We never asked him about his war experiences. I think I might have tried later on when I was in my 20s, but it was something he didn't talk about. And we had a conversation. It was interesting with Robin Roberts, and she was saying that, you know, she too, like we didn't know our dad's place in history until we were grown. But it was interesting because mom, I made sure, I think part of it that she kind of let us know is that the home was his place of solace. He had a lot to do in his job and everything else, what he represented. And she made sure that when he came home, like I said, he didn't come home to chaos and stuff. So, but I just remember that time when he came home from Vietnam. He lost so much weight. It was kind of scary.
It was scary. His hair turned white. He lost weight and he was sunbaked. Oh, and wow. I had to look at him twice to say, that's my dad. Oh my goodness.
Yeah. General, you seem like you've wanted to say some things about this experience of the traveling around as you worked your way through the Air Force, et cetera.
Well, pretty much working, bringing kids up really was Francis, because I had to be careful that folks always think, oh, that's the colonel's daughter, mm-hmm. or son. And I'm sure that affected their life experiences. I'm at work and doing the job and not necessarily not paying attention to him, but not realizing how much they were going through because of that. And that's where Francis played such a big part in their life and mine too, because of those types of relationships that we would have. So again, part of life's blessings were the type of assignments and what I gained, but the impact on the family is another story for sure.
Yeah, so it sounds like Ms. Francis, to help keep things peaceful for you, she didn't tell you everything. She just kind of took care of things so that you could, when you weren't working, you could come home and relax and kind of recharge before you had to go out on another mission.
Yep.
That whole thing of I'm going to tell your dad when he gets home. We knew that was because if he got home and had to hear something, you knew.
It wasn't a good thing.
It was going to be really, really, really bad. So she didn't really have to do much other than threaten us with it. I don't think it was too much she actually had to tell.
just put it out there, right? Ron, you told us a little bit about, your career path. Charlene and Yvonne, I'll start with you, Charlene. How was your career path affected in terms of your upbringing that brought you to where you are today?
Well, Dad instilled a real thirst for learning. And as I said, for one other thing, it wasn't always easy. I always said, you don't want him. He's not the person you go to if you want help with your homework. I remember a number of homework sessions that probably ended in tears because he was, insisting that I get this and, am I paying attention? And
why. So he was tough.
Yeah, he was, it was very clear to him what the objective was, and it was clear to him we were going to meet it.
Okay.
And sometimes, as Yvonne said, as a young girl coming along, I wasn't quite as fast and as far as he might want me to be. But he instilled in me a real love of learning. I think that's one of my highest values today, is just to continue growing and learning and changing. And I think it took me all the way up through my PhD, and I have a picture of him with me when I got my PhD, and he just looked so happy and so proud that it was a moment that I think we both just treasured. And so that's one thing that he really instilled.
Yeah, and you got to reflect back on those times when he was hard on you in the homework, but look at the accomplishment that came out of it. Yeah. And Ron, I was going to go to to Yvonne, but I saw you shaking your head when she said that he was rough on the homework tip. And you said that school was something that you had to put a little extra effort in. So I guess you remember those moments as well?
Well, in high school, I didn't. But I do remember, like, if I had a question, I would, go to him and ask him a question. And he'd always say, well, did you read the book? It's probably in the book. And I got to the point where I thought, you know what? I'm just going to read the book. I'm not even going to ask. Because I didn't know it was going to say, did I read it? Did you understand it? And I thought, no. So, yeah.
Yeah. Yvonne, how did it affect you watching your sister and your brother accomplish what they were doing through school and everything and eventually in their careers as you were also, you know, coming of age career-wise, et cetera, or, you know, school-wise, et cetera?
Growing up, I didn't have that perspective. They're just my older brother and sister. And, you know, I always thought they were always doing neat stuff because you're the youngest and you always, you know, want to do what your older brother and sister are doing. So I got to do a lot with that. Ron, being in the middle, Charlene and I have a little more age between us and she was gone. But Ron kind of let me hang out with him as long as I would do what he said. So I was so I was able to do a lot of things with Ron that he, you know, allowed me to do, including I was the person that primed his, you know, planes while he was learning that skill as a kid and everything. But I think how being a military, you know, following Dad around in his career, how it affected me was that I ended up wanting to go to an HBCU because back in those days, there wasn't a lot of cross dating unless you were a black person with a varsity letter. And then the Caucasian ladies would date them. And I remember it affected Dad in a way. It was so funny because in high school, I had dated the few eligible black men. There weren't that many blacks anyway where we were stationed. And I dated the few that there were. So I finally talked Dad and Mom into letting me date GIs. And I could date them as long as they were 19 or under because a lot of them were just, you know, their first tour and that kind of thing. But I think because of that military experience and having experienced the one time of going to a black, when Dad went to Vietnam, they bought a house in Kansas City, Missouri, because they didn't let you stay on base housing. And I got to go to a black middle school and high school. And I loved that experience of not being one of the few. And so when I graduated from high school, that made me seek an HBCU, even though, you know, a lot of the family went to the University of Illinois and wanted me to consider larger schools. I said, I want to go to a school finally where I don't have to worry about race.
Yeah.
And so that's how I made my decision. I wanted to go to Howard actually, but Mom was a little worried about me getting unleashed in Washington. She wasn't worried about Washington. She was about,
I'm sorry, getting unleashed. Is that what you said?
Yeah. I was a little bit of troublemaker in high school, believe it or not. But Hampton was right there and they had media. I knew I wanted to work in television. So I knew I wanted to work in media. So I ended up going to Hampton. But I think the military affected that because of the time. Like I said, you're talking like the 60s.
Right.
From my high school experience, 60s, 70s, it just made a difference to have that. You can finally wait to exhale. You're not having to represent the entire black race every time you come into a room.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I mean, it was this, and that was that unspoken pressure that, you know, you represented you were the colonel's daughter or the lieutenant colonel's daughter, whatever. And you were always, there was always this, you know, be prepared to represent.
Yeah.
I think me wanting to go to an HBCU, I realized, I said, I was ready to exhale.
Yeah. Who influenced you to get your pilot's license and to get your scuba diving certification? And where did that come from? Was that from Dad, from Ron, from both?
I'd say probably both, because Ron, I didn't, you know, I think it's part of what Charlene said, and that Dad raised us to believe you could do pretty much whatever you want. I didn't buy it as much as she did growing up, but I was around it, and it actually was ingrained in me. So those things actually came later in life. But Ron, you know, like I said, I was kind of a tomboy and loved hanging out with him. So none of us, they made us learn how to swim at an early age. And I just always thought, you know, we grew up watching Sea Hunt and all this other stuff on TV. So there's a lot of stuff I just thought was
Voice cool. to the Bottom of the Sea.
Exactly. And you just thought, you know, so when you had the opportunity, you just jumped on it. And it's the same thing with flying. I'd been around it and, you know, going with Dad to air shows and being on base and everything and thought it was cool. But it actually, my aviation, probably getting my pilot's license, didn't happen until I had joined the East Coast chapter of Tuskegee Airmen before Dad moved out to the East Coast.
Which you're still involved in.
Right. And so what happened, though, is back in 96, they decided that in addition to the scholarships, they wanted more of a community outreach program. And I was teaching scuba at Georgetown University at the time, but I was going to the meetings, you know, and interested. And Ted Robinson, one of the airmen, said, you should come to this meeting that we're trying to stand up an outreach program. And you know, for young kids in aviation. I said, well, I don't know anything about aviation. He said, but you work with young people. I said, but I don't know anything about aviation. He said, but you work with young people. So I said, well, okay. So I went there and helped them, you know, get the program together kind of based on how we were teaching scuba. And I said, this would probably be a lot easier if I knew how to fly. So I went and got my pilot's license. So I kind of came in, and then of course, once I started, I said, I can see why my brother and dad love it. But I remember when I first started, I didn't tell Dad right away. I was going to like make it a surprise. And then I said, well, that's stupid. I got like all this resource and knowledge right here that I could be, you know, asking questions of while I go through this. So when I finally told him, I think I probably only had maybe 5 or 6 hours. And I finally said, guess what? And he said, oh, I wish I'd known, because I've given a lot of my stuff away. He said, but I think I still have something. So he went down in the basement and he came up with these green gloves, and it was wintertime. I said, oh, this is so nice, because it is cold when I'm doing my pre-flight and stuff. And he looked at me and goes, those are in case of fire. So he'd give me his gloves that he had in Korea, and apparently they're flame retardant in case the cockpit catches on fire. But I said, Dad, I said, I don't think they talk about that as you're beginning to fly. We haven't talked about the fire yet.
Yeah.
So, but it was, he was, pleased and stuff. And this is the thing that really goes on to this day, I think, is that I actually got to fly him before he did.
Wow. There you go.
Look at her. That Rod is like, yeah, yeah.
Boom.
Boom.
I'm the youngest.
Go ahead, Ron.
I said, when I finally did get to fly him, it was interesting because Charlene, Yvonne, and Dad had gone over to Israel for Christmas and through the New Year's, I believe it was. And I was instructing on the 777 at the time. And I thought, as an instructor, you can buy any trip from a line pilot and say, hey, I'd like to fly your trip. And you can stay home with full pay. And so I found out the flight that they were coming back home on. And I bought that trip. So I flew over there and picked them up. It was interesting.
That was the coolest thing ever. If you can just imagine coming back from that vacation and having your brother and son at the helm. And of course, he took good care of us. You know, we had nice seats and they were coming by all the time, giving us all kind of goodies. And of course, part of the flight, he said, we've got a real special guest on board. And after he introduced Dad, and it seemed like there was a stream of people, you know, just coming by and congratulating Dad. And it was just such a good time. I think that's probably my best flight ever.
General, yeah. Was that a proud moment for you?
Oh my goodness, yes, to be able to first to be introduced and then to share the way it turned out was a wonderful one, and one we never forget.
Ronnie had actually kind of choked up when he was making his announcement. He came on like his regular, you know, this is Captain McGee and we're flying at 40,000 feet, whatever it was. And he was doing this usual pilot thing. And then he finally kind of broke into, and I just want to say that this is a very special flight because there's over, I think at the time, I think he said there's over 60 plus years of flight experience of McGee's on board because my father's here. And that's how he got into it. But you can tell he was choking up a little bit. And I was like,
happens to the best of us. Charlene, speaking of flying, did you ever have a desire to get your license?
You know, I often will introduce us when we're in a group as the only one in the family that's not a pilot. So I think like Mom, I thought some of us have to hold down the ground. I'm an aviation buff. I mean, I love it. I love airports. I love the whole system of them. I love air shows. And I'm a real enthusiast. Space, I mean, any of those things can really get me excited.
Gotcha.
But, I'll tell you one story. A friend of mine, I was explaining, and I did say earlier how Dad helped us all to learn to take risks. Well, right. My sister and brother got that in spades. I mean, between their flying and their scuba diving and their bungee jumping and their just you name it, they do it. So I was explaining to a friend that I guess I was the only one that didn't get the daredevil gene. And she looked at me and thought a moment and she said, well, I don't know. You married Bill. My
husband. That's a good one. Wow.
Yeah, that, and I thought about it. I said, yeah, you're right. You're right.
I said, and that tops all of us.
Have you guys been bungee jumping, Yvonne or Ron?
I did.
Okay.
I did.
And have you also parachuted, skydived?
I haven't done skydiving yet. I know Ron did in the military. I haven't done it yet. I want to, but I did do hang gliding, and that was pretty cool.
General McGee, have you ever skydived?
No.
He says, why should I jump out of a perfectly good airplane? That's how I feel, too. Charlene, you have the literary background and everything, which at some point obviously led to you writing a book about your dad. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Right. It's very clear how it began. We were all together and it was Thanksgiving, and it was the year that the Million Man March was being planned. Mm-hmm. And the goal of that was to bring together Black men from across the country. And right. The theme of that was one of atonement. You know, we're going to commit or recommit to being good fathers and, you know, good husbands and good citizens. And we were listening to the promotion of that sitting around the table. And we realized, at least for me, I thought, the men in our family and in our lives have always been good husbands, good fathers, good, you know, God-fearing people in the church, active in the community, Boy Scouts. And so we thought, there's a story that needs to be told. You know, and it's not to take anything away from the atonement. You know, we all have things we could do better, and or the mission of that particular march. But mm-hmm. It was just a clear juxtaposition to what we had experienced growing up. And so I remember that very holiday, we cleared the table of all the dishes and set Dad down at one end of it. And I had my notepad, and I think Yvonne and Ron were recording. They had their recording devices. And we started it right then. We said, Dad, tell us, what is your earliest memory? And from there, his biography.
It evolved. Yeah. Yes. You know, I had a couple of things I wanted to touch on, but that's a really great, what timing in terms of putting that all together and that being the kind of the seed for it. You guys have always been a close-knit family. I know what I was thinking is that I met your dad 9 years ago when he was 92 years young. You know, we've maintained a friendship since then, particularly in recent years when he had an opportunity to go flying in a couple of cool aircraft and land at an Air Force base and have the base commander, you know, salute him on arrival and all that kind of good stuff. But you guys, what I noticed the most, having been close to all of you for recent years, is that you're a close-knit family. And as we talk today, it's very clear how close you are as a family. So I have to at least bring it up because I do consider it's even difficult for me, a sensitive topic, and that is the passing of your mom and how that affected everybody moving forward.
Let me start this. I've often wondered what my life would have been had my mother lived. I was just a little over a year old when she passed with because of a childbirth problem with my sister. What would life have been had she lived? So we all have circumstances like that mark our way, and I guess the best thing I can say is thanks for the many blessings from above.
Sure. And then your wife, Miss Frances, she passed away, you know, at a much earlier point than anybody would have ever imagined. How did that affect you, General, and moving forward, how did you handle that?
Well, it was tough to handle it. And I've gotten to know you and others in this area because it came to me suddenly I didn't have any family within 500 miles of Kansas City, and that was too far to drive in one day. So I needed to do something about it. And that's when we ended up, I was going around, went out, Ronald was out west looking at golf courses and the homes that were provided often with courses available, and came east. And Yvonne was about to move from where she was, and we finally got together, and I guess you say we got there, we've been together ever since.
So relocation and getting closer to family was the most important thing to you as a result of her passing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I think, too, we talked about Mom always holding things together and making sure things went smoothly. And she did that too in her final months. She prepared us in so many ways, including, you know, going to pick out a casket and what dress you should have and who should get what jewelry. She had me go and buy boxes, and we sat together and went through things. And so, as she had always done, she took care of us and got us as prepared as you can.
To the very end. So she was always on top of things to the very end.
Always on top of things to the very end. And one of the things that did happen as a result is I think all of us got closer to Dad, because Mom had been an intermediary so often. And so I often say, if I'd called the house and Dad picked up, he'd sometimes say, well, here's your mom. And so that would be the main communication link. And then after her passing, he connected with us in a different way than he had before. And he put in his calendar all of the birthdays, and to this day, he sends everybody, including grandchildren, great-grandchildren, and great-great-grandchild, a birthday card on their birthday. And so he's connected in ways that I think before, you know, we left to her. And it's wonderful to have him. It'd be wonderful to have both of them, but that's just one of the things I've noticed as a change.
Sure. Ron?
I have to agree with everything that Charlene has said. Partly, I think Mom, she could have been with us longer, but I think she felt like she was holding Dad back, because Dad really did step up and took care of her. He was always there. She ended up having to go in every other day for either blood transfusion or platelets with the aplastemia that she had, and Dad was always with her, always. You know, I took it in. He was sitting in the hospital with her. He'd be by the bed. They're doing something, you know, together. They're very, very, you know, close that way. In fact, to me, during that time, I saw a difference of their closeness that normally growing up you didn't see, because Dad was always either busy or gone and Mom took care of things. But now later, it was almost the reverse. So Dad was there doing all the stuff at home and taking care of her and make sure she made her appointments, et cetera. And I think that she had decided that, you know, she was interfering more with things that he maybe still wanted to do, and made the decision just to stop taking the platelets and doing the blood stuff. But Dad totally stepped up to everyone after that and took on more of the role that Mom had the whole time. He just kind of moved right, you know, into that role. And I'm sure it was hard on him, but it's, you know, that's to his generation. That's what you did.
Yeah.
If one's not there, then you fill in the gap. You make sure that you do, and he totally did. We actually became, I think, much closer. Sad to say, but much closer as to Dad anyway in the family post mother than we were before.
You guys rally to support each other. Bottom line, so Yvonne.
Now, I've been talking about Mom's passing. One of the things that stands out that I wasn't able to do much at her funeral. I played some music because that was about all I could do. And I know Ron spoke and Dina spoke, but I remember the Dad, I don't know how he did it, but one of her favorite hymns was "How Great Thou Art." And he sang that perfectly. Mm-hmm. I mean, he didn't break or anything. And I just said the inner strength that it takes to do that. Mm-hmm. I was just in awe.
Yeah. That is incredible. That is really incredible.
That he did that. But he's always had this inner strength that it's, as you know, Vince, because you know Dad now, that he doesn't change a lot. He's, there's no pendulum swing. And he's grounded in a spiritual way that I can only just be in awe of and witness, but and he hadn't changed.
Yeah. So
that was one thing. And I know it was hard on him, but he doesn't, dad keeps his cards and his emotions close to the vest.
Yep.
And so that was, I was really excited, and I feel bad because when he, you know, pointed out that nobody's within 500 miles of him, and I said, well, I hate to say it, dad, but I don't think any of your kids are coming to Kansas City.
I'm not going to touch that one. I got to go to Kansas City soon. I don't want to touch it.
I mean, at the time, you know, we were all had careers and were working, and, you know, Dina and Bill were really well established in the university there. And Ron was, you know, still flying actively. So when he made that decision to come out this way, it was it wasn't anything we planned. It was just kind of like he just is so practical about life.
Yeah.
And the fact that he left his heart in Kansas City to make the move to be closer to family, just it says a lot.
It really does. I want to say thank you to all of you for sharing such something so personal and being so candid with it. As we wrap up here, I wanted to ask all of you to talk about something that is near to my heart with your dad. I gotta watch myself not to get emotional about it. But, you know, in recent years, people have asked me, they're like, you know, you haven't known General McGee very long. Why do you do all these things for him? And I said, you know, once I learned more about the Tuskegee Airmen and about the accomplishments, particularly of Brigadier General McGee or Colonel McGee at the time, I felt compelled to, hey, he needs some more recognition. I mean, this is a shame to see that this guy is turning 99, 100, 101, and he's just now being recognized for great things that he did 30, 40, 50 years ago. So a lot of that was the motivation for me. I was wondering how all of you have felt about seeing your father finally get, don't get me wrong. I don't want to make it seem like he hasn't been recognized, because he has. He's gotten medals and accommodations and things like that. But, you know, the things like the honorary promotion to Brigadier General and other types of recognition that you guys have been involved in at all of these different, I call them alphabet events, these aviation events, the Aviation Hall of Fame, et cetera, those have come in more recent years. And I just wanted to hear you guys' perspective and the general's perspective about that.
Charlene?
Whoever wants to go.
Oh, I've been designated.
You're the eldest.
I am so I'm so happy that at this point in his life, he is celebrated. I think that the things that he's done, as Yvonne said, have been consistent, and they have been selfless in so many ways. He's not done any of it for self-aggrandizement, and he's the last person to talk about his achievements.
Absolutely.
The best thing I enjoyed about traveling with him, if we were to go to a book event or a speaking event, is I could tell people what he had done. I said, I'm gonna tell you what his medals are, because he won't tell you. And I'm gonna tell you what his records are, because he won't tell you. And so he was always other oriented. And to watch him continue to use his gifts and his achievements to motivate the next generation coming along is just an awesome gift and a blessing. And it's something that I'm so grateful for. We kind of tease him and say, Dad, there's no more room on your counters or walls for any more awards. But somehow—
No, the house is a museum pretty much now.
It's a museum, and we're trying to collect things and give them to people who want mementos, or, you know, want to have something on display. But it is just a continued blessing to see the recognition, but more importantly, the impact of the recognition on people who need to have a role model. They need to have an inspiration. They need to have hope. And I think that's what he brings.
Yeah. Ron, I can give you and Yvonne a chance. I know I hit a nerve, so you can give me the edited version, or we can move past it if you'd like.
No. I was just saying, you know, Dad is not only extremely accomplished and everything that he applies himself to through his four P's, and we all know what the four P's are, but he's also, like Charlene just alluded to, one of the most humble persons that you've ever met. And one of the alpha models, you have to be, first of all, you have to be a servant of all. And Dad is exactly that. And he gives so much back and doesn't expect anything in return. He always says, well, why me? You know, I don't know why I'm getting these things. Why me? And when you look at it and you know who he is, you go, oh my gosh, how could you even say that? You go, why not you? Who else out there is like you that is more deserving of the recognition?
One of a kind.
Mm-hmm. One of a kind.
Yeah.
That's one thing that I've been able to witness when we moved in together was how consistent he is in that he enjoys life on life's terms. And so the awards and the acknowledgement and all the accolades and stuff, he just accepts as, well, this is part of my life. And I don't want to say he's not excited about it, because he really is appreciative of it. But I think I've said this before, he always sees how it fits into a bigger picture, and it's not just about him. And when things happen, it always was interesting to me, because I'm one of those people, I'm not saying that I'm not genuine, but there's certain people I can get kind of giddy around certain folks and get excited and stuff. And he has that excitement, but he gets just as excited in a classroom full of kids as he does going into the White House.
Thank you for that segue, because that's exactly the positive note that I wanted to start closing the show out on. So go ahead, Yvonne.
No, but I'm just saying that, but to witness that, and that his whole thing of like, you treat everybody equally. I mean, he just, everything that he talks about, he is who he is. It's not just verbiage as it is with some people. When, you know, they say one thing and they do something else behind closed doors, he's the exact same person all the time, and he treats everyone with respect and stuff. And that's just amazing to witness. I wish I had it. I love seeing it, so I know it's attainable.
Yeah.
But it's just amazing to be able to witness that in his lifetime, in my lifetime.
So this is perfect, because it's time for us to kind of wrap up our conversation. And I wanted to talk about that with you guys in terms of the inspiration that your father gives to a lot of young people, to our next generation that are interested in aviation and aerospace or whatever it is. It can be anywhere of anything, particularly in the world of STEM. And just wanted to hear you guys' thoughts about that and the things that he's done. I've witnessed him going to talk to the younger generation at the Air and Space Museum. And by the time the word got out that he was there and that he was going to speak, the place would just be overflowing with people, young and old.
Well, I too am kind of amazed that he reaches and connects on a real visceral level with young people who are four generations, you know, younger and more.
Right.
And it's amazing to see it in action. I think one of the things I've heard him recently saying to a group of young people is, I've had my high flight, but what about you? He said, we are going to put mankind on Mars in 2035, and maybe that's something that you can do. And you just see their eyes get big.
Right.
He just opens the possibilities in such a way that it's really palpable. And I think that's a legacy that will keep on giving for, you know, generations to come.
Yeah. And he reminds them. I've heard him talk to kids and say, or watched him talk to kids and say, yeah, you know, by the time you finish school and are in a space program or something, you're probably one of the ones that will be traveling to another planet.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Ron?
You know, it's just interesting to watch youth that are around him. Sometimes someone will come up like at Oshkosh, and they'll come up to him because their parents said, oh, you know, you need to go meet this man, or you need to go get this thing. But the parents, you know, influence that. But sometimes a child will come up just because they have the ability to communicate with them and make them feel better about themselves and what they can achieve. And I know in Oshkosh one time, there was a kid who did that, and he bought an airplane. I think his dad signed the wing of the airplane. And then later, when we were out in the lobby, this kid was running around going like, I got, at that time he was Colonel, because I got Colonel McGee's signature. I got Colonel McGee's signature. And he was elated that he, as a youth, had dad's signature. Yeah. But that's the way dad affects people.
Yeah, yeah. Yvonne?
That is interesting. I mentioned, I think, before that one of the worst things that a young person can say when dad is talking to them, and he talks to kids he doesn't even know just on the street and stuff, and he might engage them in conversation if they're standing around, is, I don't know. And he's got to challenge them to continue to think and expand. It's like, well, you know, have you been to the library? Have you done certain things? He's going to challenge them on the spot. But one thing that really touched me is he went over to a school in France, I think it was. And anyway, all the kids wrote letters to him after he came back, thanking him for his visit. And he put those, some of them he put in a little book he kept. I don't know if he still had it or not, but he used to, you know, because he gets so much stuff from people thanking him for things. But the one letter, and so each of the kids in this classroom had to write him a letter. And the one kid said that he was just about to give up on life, which touched me. It was a sixth grade. He said, until I heard you share your story. And I just said, to have that kind of a profound effect on a young person that he doesn't even know is just part of the blessing that dad has been able to share with everyone, that has such an impact. But to have this person, you know, from all the way over in France, to say he was touched by dad's presence and the fact that he spent time to come talk to their class about things that they could do. Yeah. And that it's not going to always be easy, and it's not always going to be fair, and it's not always going to be what you think your life is supposed to be, but you can still have a good life.
Sure. Go ahead, Ron.
Other adults have the ability to see how dad affects and interacts with children too. Because I know he went to South Africa and talked to some youth there, but when he came back, he got a call from someone in the State Department wanting to know if he would go over to Georgia to talk to youth there, because the youth were having, you know, a lot of problems and not motivated and weren't doing well, et cetera. And they wanted dad to go over trying to be a motivational speaker to the teenagers in Georgia. And dad went overseas, you know.
Not the state of Georgia.
Yeah, I was saying, I think we're talking Russia.
Yeah, exactly. So he went over for, I think, a week and talked to and motivated some, you know, youth overseas.
Yeah, yeah. Brigadier General McGee, your closing thoughts about inspiring the next generation?
Well, not just inspiring them, but for you and this family gathering brings tears to my eyes. But it's one of the blessings from God that guides me in what I do. As Ronald mentioned, I often say, why me, how me? I can't put my finger on any part of my life that the question doesn't stand out. I have been blessed. This gathering is a blessing, another of the blessings. Thank you.
Yeah, well, I will say to you in advance, Happy Father's Day. And Ron or Charlene or Yvonne, any closing comments as we wrap this up?
Now, I just want to say thank you, Vince, because, again, had given us this opportunity to share some of our things with folks about dad. This could be like a 2-month-long show, but we know you have limited time, so we'll keep it short. But I just want to
say we could have done it for about a week. Yeah.
Ron can do stand up for a good couple hours on his own about some things, but I just want to say thanks, Vince, and I hope you have a great Father's Day too.
Yeah, thank you very much.
You too, Ron.
Thank you.
And then, yeah, Happy Father's Day, Ron. I'm sorry. Yeah. Yeah. Well, this has been, again, an honor and a privilege to have this opportunity, but it's been a wonderful conversation with you guys. And it was something that I really wanted us to be able to do. And that's talk about what I would call the other side, the family side of all the accomplishments over a century with Dad. So, but thank you all. And you guys take care. General Ron, you enjoy your Father's Day. And Yvonne and Charlene, it's great to see you guys as always.
All right. You as well.
Thank you.
All right. Oh, my goodness. Now, that is the definition of cool and fun. Chatting family style with a national treasure and his children really doesn't get any better than that. As a father of three of my own, what a great way to celebrate Father's Day. What an honor and privilege it has been to have Brigadier General Charles McGee, his daughter, Charlene McGee Smith, his son, Ron McGee, and the youngest of the three, Yvonne McGee, as guests on Profiles of Color. As you all know, each week, I do a deep dive, casual conversation, looking into the lives of inspiring individuals who have compelling, often revealing, and definitely enlightening stories to tell. Profiles of Color is a multimedia production of the Private Air Media Group and is available on your favorite podcast app. Guest bookings for Profiles of Color are coordinated by our booking producer, Christine Richards. To continue enjoying Profiles of Color, please remember to subscribe to your favorite podcast app. Thanks a million for being a loyal listener. Stay safe, take care, and have a good one.